Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the staff writer for The Atlantic behind the excellent story of Donald Trump's purging of essential government employees, Franklin Four. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Green Chef, Delete Me, 3-Day Blinds, and Miracle Made, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it helps make this podcast happen. Hey, James, you know, at one point in President Trump's interminably long New York Times interview, he said he could do anything he wanted, and the only thing that could stop him was his morality. Now, I wonder if he really meant mortality, because morality and Donald Trump are total strangers. He is on a high. He feels he's on a high now. That's dangerous. He thinks his toughness is paying off in Venezuela, ICE brutality in Minneapolis, threats to take over Greenland, bomb Iran, and going after the chairman of the Federal Reserve. I think he could be proven wrong on all counts. Resistance is building, not enough with Republicans, but it's still building. Close to a dozen top federal prosecutors in Minneapolis or in Washington, Virginia, are resigning. That doesn't happen very often, unwilling to accept lawless orders for prosecuting Trump's enemies or partisan investigations in Minnesota. Now, the courts won't let him get away with ignoring their order about not retaining the legally challenged prosecutor in Virginia. They said, I'm sorry, she cannot serve there. And he came back and said, oh, yes, she can. He can't get a reputable prosecutor to do his political bidding. In addition to Mark Kelly now, he's going after Alyssa Slotkin for telling our soldiers and sailors that our military code of justice makes it unlawful to follow an illegal order. With Trump in the White House and Hegseth at the Pentagon, this is more than just an academic question. And I believe it's a political mistake, James, to get in a fight with Kelly and Slotkin, two very smart politicians with impressive national security credentials. And look, the regime in Iran is atrocious. We should do anything possible to undermine it. But bombing the country may produce dangerous retaliations and get us into more of a conflict than we want. And finally, when a Ford factory worker yelled pedophile protector at him, I think that's the term he used, his name was TJ Sabula, Trump yelled back, F you, and gave him the finger. Ford suspended Mr. Tebula. He didn't threaten the president. He just exercised his free speech. So I hope the UAW, and there's a GoFundMe set up while he's suspended, will rise to his defense. But I'll tell you what else that incident shows, James. For all the talk about the Epstein issue going away, it still really gets to Trump.
It does, and I think you made a very, very important point, and that is morality, he doesn't know the meaning of that, but mortality is something that he focuses on, and of course, he's so fucking demented, he can't remember which word to pull up. But I completely 100% agree with your assessment of what he meant to say. In terms of the auto worker, the Ford worker that yelled at Trump, I'm happy to report through connections to my dear friend, Helen Brosnan, who's your dear friend and her dad is a dear friend of both of us, who is the communications director for the United Auto Workers, that they're going to be a vigorous defense of this gentleman. When I say vigorous, I mean vigorous. You know, I love that they talk about anti-free speech and cultural authoritarianism and all of the things, and then they get an auto worker fired for what the ultimate free speech is, telling the president what you think. Better get this guy to mail him on instead of firing him.
Right.
Honestly. But, you know, he's not alone, I can assure you. That's one of the good things.
Well, I'm glad to hear that the UAW, that's good, that's great reporting, James. And there is also a GoFundMe while he's suspended.
Yeah, absolutely. And we should definitely send to that. But this is all of the, just to show you what absurd people they were, you know, oh man, they do this. They're not free speech. They got speech codes. They got everything. And then they get this guy fired. And I guess Ford, like anything else, they got to act like they're trying to help Trump to stay alive. But it's deteriorating by the day. I want to ask you while I got you here, because this struck me as a big fucking deal, but you tell me, that going to that woman's house, that reporter for the Washington Post, and start confiscating her shit because of a story she's working right on? I mean, isn't that, to say the least, highly unusual?
It was highly unusual under any normal administration. I can't say it hasn't happened, but it didn't happen very often. This is about a alleged bribery case in Maryland. The reporter, the Post reporter, is obviously not involved in it. They're just trying to get to see if she has the information. I hope the Post goes after them on this. I don't know if the Washington Post, still has Williams and Connolly. If they do, they'll go after him on this, because I think this was just totally unjustified.
Yeah, it just struck me. He just gets inched, not an inch. He's very clear that he wants to be an authoritarian. I mean, he can't be any clearer about his desire.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing is, I think the country is turning on him, I mean, like in real time, like by the day. And, man, you look at the polling, this Venezuela stuff, you look at the ICE, you look at across the board, it's not that it's bad for him, it's horrific. It's hard for me to really get my head around what these midterms are going to look like. I just, for the life of me, maybe I'm a guy that, keeps doubling down on the theory, because I think you're pretty much the same place I am. But I just don't see anything remotely that you would consider evidence that wouldn't say the Democrats are just going to have a monster year in the 26 elections.
No, I think you're right. And they're getting good candidates. Like, they just got that Senate candidate in Alaska who really could win that race. And, the Atlantic, which I really like, had a piece that I found not very good. It said the MAGA people have not deserted Trump. Okay, they haven't. If you're talking about MAGA and the people, the really rich guys who will be in it, for the end, for their tax breaks and everything, that may be, at one point I said 39%. I don't know what it is really, but it's that extra 10%. That he needs to win an election. Republicans need to win an election. You know what? They aren't there now. They are not.
They're not. Now, I read the same piece you did, and there's this effort in all across the legacy media, mainstream, but I don't know what the fuck they call it, to say, well, Trump's actually stronger than you think he is. No, he's not. And by the way, if he loses MAGA, he got 49 cent and change. MAGA's only worth 40. He got a lot of non-MAGA votes, and he's losing them like crazy, and he can't afford to lose any of them votes, and he's starting to lose a few of them too. But it's the whole thing. You don't know how powerful Trump is. You wait. The close is coming in. The Democrats think they're going to do so well in 2026. You wait till Donald Trump hits the campaign trail. Oh, shit. I wish he'd come on campaign trail every day. Every day. But, yeah.
He did great at Ford, didn't he? James, I want to, I first of all, I think his incredible arrogance goes all the way back. He was there anyway, but it goes back to June 2024 Supreme Court decision, which Trump believes gave him a blank check to do whatever he wants to. The only thing that could stop him is his own mortality, if you will. But I want to pick up on this Federal Reserve and Jay Powell threat, because it really is more disturbing than almost anything. The Federal Reserve is certainly not infallible. They've made clear mistakes, some believe, even under Powell. But its independence is crucial, as every president would love to goose up the economy right before an election. Sometimes that's a good idea. Sometimes it's not. I have a little history in this because I'm so old. In 1971, Richard Nixon went after the Fed chairman, his old friend Arthur Burns. I was a young Wall Street Journal reporter. In the middle of it, the White House hatchet man, Chuck Colson, tried to use me to plant a story about how bad Burns was and what he was doing. We didn't go along, but the bullying worked, and Burns basically capitulated. So Nixon wins the 72 election in a landslide. But, pretty soon that great economy began cratering with massive inflation. It was it's a terrible thing to do that. And Arthur Burns will live in infamy because of that. And remember, 1933, one of the first things Hitler wanted to do was to get rid of the German central bank's independence. That's what authoritarians do. And on the issue, I give great credit to the usually reserved Jay Powell, who, by the way, is being represented by Williams and Connolly. Powell went public to call out the phony charge they might indict him for cost overruns at the Federal Reserve. It was about Trump bullying him for lower interest rates. My guess is that was crafted in part by Michelle Smith, the communications chief at the Fed, the best communications executive in the executive branch I've known in 50 years in Washington. But credit also to a couple Republicans like Tom Tillis and Lisa Murkowski who went after Trump on this, but there were very few. The chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, French Hill, called it an unnecessary distraction. No, Congressman, it's corruption. It's a lie. That's what it was. And where is the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, Tim Scott, on the Fed's independence? What are you afraid of, Senator?
Of course, it's all across the massive ability to be manipulated that the modern Republican Congressional Party has to be run over. I don't know the exact word that you want to use, but there has never been a Congress less interested in exerting its Article One power than this Congress is. It's become a subservient branch of government. And fortunately, I can assure you that is going to change in the next Congress that's going to take office in January of 2027. It's not going to be this one, and it's not going to be a compliant organization. It's going to be very, very aggressive. And we owe it to the country to pick up as many seats as we can. By the way, we're talking about Congress. I want to say something James, nice about somebody that doesn't get a lot of nice things said about, and that's Senator Charles Schumer. Senator Schumer basically has two big jobs. One is to maneuver with a minority legislatively to put the Republicans in a maximum difficult position. They are there this January. Number two, and maybe even bigger than that, is the ability to recruit good candidates to run in this cycle. And he's done a pretty damn good job at doing that. And he might not be the best on Sunday morning TV.
Sure has.
But he's done a damn good job. And you know, sometimes in politics, you have to call about people when you disagree with them. You don't think they're doing a good job. But sometimes you got to take your hat off. And Senator Schumer, you've done great on recruiting and you've done great on legislative maneuvering here. We're in a very good position and you can certainly feel like you're part of it.
Well, James, you're right on. I mean, getting that Alaska candidate was a real coup. I think she can beat Dan Sullivan. That's at least a 50-50 race right now. Roy Cooper in North Carolina, Sherrod Brown in Ohio, Tallarico in Texas, if he'll quit stiffing this program, will be a great candidate. He really has done a first rate job.
He has, and they're getting more and more. I mean, he's using this is an optimum time to be recruiting really good candidates. I think that having Janet Mills in Maine is going to turn out to be, it seems Planter's got some enthusiasm, but I think in the end she's going to win. And I think if she runs against Susan Collins, she'll win that race too. It's been a little dicey. Look at Ohio. I mean, getting sure to run is pretty damn big. And he's working in all states like Kansas and Indiana and other places like that to see the best candidates in position. But, Senator Schumer, you get a lot of flack. But in this term, I think you deserve a hats off, an attaboy.
Yeah, no, I absolutely, agree. There may even be enough on the side to give a little credit to JB. But I also, you know, I think one of the he'll hate me for saying that, James. Yeah. One of the, I think, under the radar races is Iowa. I think it's going to be a really good year in Iowa in 2026, which hasn't had a really good Democratic year in, 14 years. And I think they have several strong candidates on the Democratic side. They're not running against an incumbent. They could well win the governorship. So, I think that's got to go on the list, too.
I don't think Iowa's I think Iowa's at the top tier. I think, actually, I put Iowa and Ohio in kind of the same box. Maybe, if anything, a slight edge to Iowa. I mean, if you look at the recent election returns, you look at where people are, you look at what's happening in the agrarian economy, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing is, we're going to win the governor's race. That matters in an off year because you don't have that much ticket splitting. But we're in the pole position by far in the governor's race. I mean, Rob is going to win that. And, you know, I think that, and I defer to you on this, but I think there are like three potential House seats in Iowa. There's three Republicans, and they're not sitting on very big.
There are.
It's all in that northwest corner that the Republican partisan advantage comes in to kick in. And the same thing's true in Pennsylvania.
I think that, oh boy, you know, every time you put up a discharge petition, you get two or three Pennsylvania Republicans who's running. They are scared stiff right now.
They know. I don't know if they can get away from it. I mean, whatever his name is in Bucks County District, he's trying to do everything he can to get from under this animal lock. Good luck.
Well, I think I'd still bet on him. He's one of the great survivors of all time. But there are three others, two up in Northeast Pennsylvania, and that's Scott Perry around. It's not Harrisburg, but it's close to there, who is a real right winger and barely won last time.
We got to get our friend Brendan Byrne back on here sometime soon and talk about what's at stake in Pennsylvania, because there's a lot congressionally. I mean, we can have a monster beer picking up there for sure.
Huge. Well, all right. I mean, is there anything else we haven't covered? We've covered a lot today, James.
Well, the problem is, Albert, there's a lot to cover. Okay. I mean, you know, it used to be.
That's the problem.
I mean, it's just hard to imagine how terrible this is, you know, but I think we covered a lot.
You can get very despondent, but it's turning around. And I think it's a little indicator, but the fact that he went so ballistic at J.B. Sebula, whatever his name is, the auto worker in Ford, I mean, he just hit really rattled Trump.
It did. And the valuable piece of intelligence is, wherever he is, you should have people shout, pedophile protector, pedophile protector. You know that gets to him. We don't need anything else to get under his skin. We know what it is. Print signs, show up, do anything you can. Go to town halls when these Republicans are speaking and say, do you agree that with this auto worker that Trump is a pedophile protector? Would you investigate this? Why doesn't he want, you know, whatever it is, Trump had a massive negative reaction to it. And when you find a sore spot, you keep hitting it. Keep hitting it. Hit that sore tooth hard all over the country. Greg just called him the pedophile protector.
And this is a sore spot that won't go away. And for all the people say, well, you know, there's no indication he's done anything, why the hell is he trying to keep it as quiet as he can? Why the hell? I will tell you, James, what worries me, and I hope there's some civil servants still left over at the Justice Department, because I don't trust Pam Bondi and Todd Blanche to put out everything on the Epstein files.
Apparently, neither does Trump. He doesn't like Pam Bondi now, according to a lot of pretty good reporting. I mean, I think it was even in the Wall Street Journal. They're going to get rid of
her. Yeah, it was in the Wall Street Journal.
They're going to get rid of her, but you're not going to say any better. And Todd Blanche, Emil Bovine, whatever his fucking name is. I mean, you know, they better do everything they can, because come next.
He's on the appeals court now.
Yeah, he's on the appeals court now? Wow. Yeah, and the reason that Trump
in the Third Circuit, unbelievable.
The Supreme Court told him he was.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, that Department of Justice has been shredded. I mean, it's absolutely been shredded. Every single department over there.
Minneapolis. And this is what I want to talk to Frank about. We've blown a huge hole in talent with the federal government. I don't think that you can just come back in 2029 and fill that up. I mean, if you're losing prosecutorial expertise, these people are going to go get jobs. They're going to work in big law firms in Minneapolis and Chicago. All right. and they're not going to come back.
Or go to Singapore.
Yeah, go to Singapore.
Right,
The inspectors, Weather Bureau, all the places that you have to have, Forestry Service, all the places that you really need expertise, they're going to be gone. And this is really true in these U.S. Right. Attorney's Office. And these are critical freaking people in our system of justice. I mean, really critical.
James, wait. They have a problem. Okay. These people believe in the law. That's a real problem in some of these cases. Because this is a administration that does not.
Right. You know, when these lawyers have been in the Justice Department that long and they have a certain reflex to follow the law, these guys are going to go. They're not going to listen to this shit. And a lot of these people are really talented and are going to get really good jobs in the private sector. This guy in Minnesota, if I ever got in trouble in Minnesota, I'd want him for a criminal attorney.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, you know, if you want to bet on Jay Powell, there was reason to bet on him anyway. And when I learned that he also has Williams and Connolly as his lawyer, I think I'd double down on that bet right now.
Great.
Franklin Foer of The Atlantic, one of America's leading journalists and a guest on this program before, has written a really important, if depressing, piece on the Donald Trump and Elon Musk purge massacre of 300,000 federal employees and the damage it's causing. Franklin, thanks, first of all, for being here. You spent 4 months and interviewed over 50 former federal workers who left most of them involuntarily over the past year. And I think what really was significant, you write that obviously there is some dead wood in the federal government, as there is in every organization or bureaucracy. But Trump has disproportionately fired people with knowledge and expertise in important matters of governance that affect our citizens. Talk about that.
It's so hard to wrap one's mind around the enormity of what has befallen our government. And I wanted to do something that reflected both the scale of what's occurred, but also to make it human enough so that people could connect with this big abstraction that is the government. I mean, people don't think about the fact that people are unaware of the fact, I would say, that 80% of our government exists outside of Washington, D.C., right. And that our government is so dispersed. There's so many corners of it that I think even wizened political hands like yourselves don't know about. And it turns out that a lot of these small corners of the government do incredibly important things, and that our country is an ecosystem and the government is part of the ecosystem. And you take the government out of that ecosystem and then things, maybe not in the short term, but eventually start to collapse in those places.
Yeah, there's so many examples. We'll get to some. One example is NIH. I think you talk, is it Michael Lehrer?
Lauer.
He had brought transparency and higher quality to NIH, and he resigned when Trump demoted personnel and froze grants. I know stormtroopers, it was the highest levels. They marched into Francis Collins' office, the respected NIH head, and just said, out, get out. Talk about the damage that this causes there at NIH.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that I hadn't really focused my mind around is that so many of the great government accomplishments feel sometimes like they're in the past. So, you know, NASA, the Apollo program is the classic example. That feels like something that happened in a different era of American life. But NIH does all these incredible things that are happening right now, that the Human Genome Research Project is something that occurred at the late 20th century into this century, where we have this incredible map of all of the building blocks of human life. And that's something that the government was able to accomplish because only the government could do that type of research at scale that required that level of coordination. And it's we have this map, and then the NIH keeps doing all these things to take advantage of the fact that we have this map to develop gene-based therapies, to treat rare diseases, to make these types of treatments accessible to people, that once you have a genetic understanding of a cancer tumor, you can design treatments for that tumor. Somebody like Michael Lauer was taking all of this money that the government spends through NIH on medical research, and he was ensuring that it was done in the most transparent sort of way, because, you know, once that money leaves the door, you know it's a big investment. You want to make sure that people are publishing the results of their research. They're not just taking advantage of all this government money in order to develop drugs that they're hoarding, or you want to make sure that that they're adhering to the highest ethical standards as they go about doing their tests. And that requires having operators in Bethesda at the NIH who have the deepest medical expertise, who understand the research process in a way where nobody's going to be able to kind of fleece them, and are demanding of the hospitals and universities that they, if we're gonna make these investments, that investment yields public goods
and save lives over the long run. And they're going to be, it's going to be very hard to get some of those scientists back that they're letting go. I mean, you're not going to just snap a figure in 2029 and say, okay, come back now, you're welcome.
Right. And you know, the thing that's hard to wrap our mind around is that we think, okay, there are all these incredibly bright entrepreneurial people in the private sector doing all sorts of amazing things, and they exist, but there are certain things as it relates to research that require years and years, where there is no obvious profit, where you need to make prospective bets, where the market is not going to step in to fund that kind of research. Universities aren't going to step in to fund that kind of research because it requires resources that they don't possess. Government in the post-war era became the backbone for all of the most important discoveries that we were making that end up saving people's lives. And that only works if you have people who are expert, who are attracted to that field. And, you know, what you're getting at is that there was a bargain. Like, these people were taking lower wages in order to do this public work because it was exciting, because it was important, because they believed that it could make a difference. And once they kind of understand that, you know, in 4 years they could get fired by somebody who is going to capriciously manipulate the system, it becomes a much less attractive proposition for the best and brightest.
Yeah, that's the macro, and really important macro. You also see it in the micro. In the first week in office, Trump went to Western North Carolina, still suffering from Hurricane Helene, and said, "I'll tell you, with me, you're not going to be forgotten." Well, as he tries to dismantle FEMA with no replacement, those people down there are still suffering. People whose homes were destroyed. So there's a federal program that when they're certifiably destroyed, that the federal government supplies replacement funds. And there are people down there who haven't gotten that yet, a year and a half later, still paying mortgages on destroyed homes. This is a small example. It only affects probably a couple thousand people, or more affected. But it's exactly what happens when you say, okay, I'm going to get rid of something, and you have no idea if you're going to replace it with anything.
Right. Well, the point is that government can be a barrier as easily as it can become an opportunity. That when you have a community right. that's been damaged, and the fact that there are these funds that exist in theory to help them rebuild, it just becomes frustrating and maddening that they're sitting there and you can't find a way to access them because there are all sorts of barriers. And what I, you know, you look at the best people within FEMA. These were people who knew how to not just respond to a hurricane or a flooding or disaster, but there were people who understood like how to access that money that exists for the purpose of rebuilding and make it possible for a small business owner or for a school board to get those funds so that they could rebuild.
Well, I'm going to just one quick one and turn it over to James. I mean, he knows a lot about, you know, some of that stuff for sure. You know, there is this charge, not only the charge, but a sense among a lot of people. We have this huge bloated public workforce with lazy bureaucrats. It's a myth. Our government workforce as a percentage is actually smaller than most European countries, all Scandinavian countries. And it was bureaucrats, mainly on the state and local levels, who were the heroes of 9/11. It was of the 9/11 responders. It was the bureaucrats who have helped save the Pentagon that day. And it's an underappreciated story because it makes for easy demagoguery.
Yeah.
Frank.
James will remember reinventing government, and the government does need to be reinvented and updated for the age of AI and the like. But one of the things that I think that government, our system of government, does poorly is that it has a layer of political appointees that's much larger than in any other country of our standing. That every 4 years you have a bunch of you have people who descend. Obviously, we want our bureaucracy to respond to political leadership, but we've created so many positions across the bureaucracy that are political appointments, where you have people coming in who don't necessarily have expertise and understanding of the departments that they're running, that they all come in and they start to change priorities in ways that reflect their egos as much as their ideologies. And so you have a lot of whiplash that happens in these departments. And I think that there's a way that if I was to reform our bureaucracy magically, I would create greater professionalization. I would shrink the layer of political managers who come in at every 4 years to create a little bit more consistency and to try to restore the fundamental ethos of our civil service, which is that they're supposed to be disinterested, meaning that they're not supposed to be ideologically motivated, that they exist in order to serve a public good at the responsive to their political leaders, that you want. And we saw this in Iraq, right? And this is like that's maybe the classic example of where you had people who had opinions grounded in neutral expertise. When they weren't able to when political leadership shut them out, they were shutting out the best possible advice that they could have gotten to deal with the problem right that they wanted to encounter. And you see this across the board.
James, you know a lot about this. Pick up on this.
I'm thinking, you know, my dad was a third-class postmaster, which would be the very definition of a minor bureaucrat, but we always proud of it. I didn't know he earned a lesser living than someone else. And then the postal inspectors would come. And I think they all were conscientious people. They tried to do their job. And I think I'm right, but maybe you can fact check me. I don't think the federal workforce is any bigger today than it was 50 years ago.
Yeah.
I think most people don't realize that.
Yeah.
Oh, hell, we're sitting there giving each other goddamn jobs. Actually, they're not. But you and I know this, and Al knows this. There are a lot of people that have invaluable experience and knowledge. You point out the NIH, which we can all understand. But we can talk about the FDA. We can talk about the FAA. We can talk about the USDA and food inspectors. We can talk about the SEC and regulating financial markets. We can talk about local U.S. attorneys, the Justice Department, where we're seeing three people in Minneapolis quit. We're going to lose a lot of people in this coming 3 years.
Yes.
And I would remind people what Bob Rubin said when he came to the Treasury Department. He said he didn't notice one iota difference in talent between Goldman Sachs and the federal employees at the Treasury Department. But the next president is going to have to...
Except, James, they were making only 1/50th as much and were more dedicated. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, I don't mind being interrupted. But we're going to have a gap in expertise.
Yeah.
And some of these people, like these guys in Minneapolis, or these women, or whoever they are, they're going to get jobs as criminal defense attorneys. And compound that times tens of thousands of times across the federal government, the next president is going to have a hell of a time bringing this entire government back to execute what we all thought was his mission.
And I don't know how you do that, because there was this bargain, like I said, that was made between these experts, these federal workers, and the government, where, you know, you may be getting a fifth of what you were getting paid at Goldman Sachs, but you were able to do this thing that where you were trusted and you had a career that you were able to build. And you just think about how wasteful this is, that the federal government has invested in the careers of all these people the Trump administration has ushered to the door. That if you are a foreign service officer, for instance, it means that you've been given, there's no manual really about how you can serve in another country and represent the United States and deal with all of the contingencies and crises that you deal with if you are a top level foreign service. And you only figure that out by experience and by having people who've done it before you, who can transmit some of the folk wisdom and some of the tricks of the trade, so that you're not having to relearn from start how to operate in a country where maybe they're hostile to you, or all of the difficulties of operating abroad. And so I think that the disappearance of expertise matters in the next presidency, but it's going to matter over generations, because that wisdom is transmitted and handed down through the generation.
Right. Now, just as an example, one of the things that we were panicked about Katrina is they lost so many musical instruments that a whole generation had to be retrained. Just the number of trumpets and they had to, because when you blow a hole, because a lot of this stuff is, like most stuff, knowledge is passed on generations or employees. But I want to ask you about, I think the guy, the OMB director, which is one of the most powerful people in the United States government, I think his name is Kevin Roberts, right?
No, Russ Vaught.
Russ Vaught, I'm sorry. He fantasized about the glee he would see watching federal employees getting fired and be in pain. The guy did that.
Yeah.
I mean, no, Russell Voigt fantasized. I'm sorry, Kevin Roberts, I apologize to you, but thank you, Frank, for correcting me.
I mean, Kevin Roberts doesn't deserve an apology either, but that's okay.
Okay.
He would have too.
That maybe the most important person in the federal workforce is fantasizing about causing custom inspectors pain.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's also, I mean, it's unbelievable. It's cruel. But as we're saying, it's so short-sighted, because government is the one instrument we have for our collective will, that institutions are things that kind of accrete and accumulate over time, sometimes in ways where they get a little bit out of control and we need to reform them and curb them. But the fact is that institutions that exist over time reflect kind of a lot of the wisdom of history. We would never create a Department of Agriculture necessarily right now if this was just an expression of the political will of the moment or what. But these things exist and they develop pockets within them that just do these important things for everyday existence that make everyday existence better. You know, McKinsey consultant is never going to come up with a plan for government that's going to be superior, I think, to the things that we've inherited over time through history, through crisis, through farsighted leadership. And it's just, the political winds in our country aren't going to blow in the same sort of direction where there's going to be enthusiasm for creating these things again. So once they're gone, a lot of them are just gone.
So before I turn it right back to Alan, Frank, you had a reputation justified, I think, of being somewhat of a polymath when it comes to following different stories, and understand you follow Ukraine very closely. Could you give us a 90-second briefing of where you see things right now in the Ukraine-Russian conflict?
I mean, right now, Trump has kind of his delusions that he's going to be able to negotiate some sort of peace agreement with Vladimir Putin, who has no ultimate interest in negotiating peace for a war that he believes that he's winning. And so, my great fear is that the Western alliance is breaking down before our eyes, that Trump is privileging Greenland in his agenda over the preservation of NATO, and that I think Zelensky's got good reason to worry that his hour of abandonment is approaching.
Thank you, Al.
Hey, Franklin, let's just talk about, put the faces on some of those workers that you wrote so well about. I hope I'm pronouncing the names right. Mikella White, of USAID. She was known for her ability to improvise and trouble spots. She served in Libya, Haiti, Sudan, dangerous assignments when she was pregnant. She saved lives. She was desperately trying to get food for starving Sudanese, ordered back to Washington and fired.
Right. Again, this is, I don't see this capacity coming back to the U.S. government that we had. You know, we had some of the best fixers in the world. So if in Ukraine there were people who were about to starve, somebody like Mikella White knew how to get food into the country, to navigate all the bureaucratic impediments that exist, to deal with all of the NGOs, to deal with all of the European partners. I mean, to me, this is kind of the epitome of what the best government servants are able to do, which is that they're able to step into crises and to whatever the obstacles are to can make things happen. And that's because she started off as a 29-year-old in Haiti who, there was the earthquake there, was able to come in, and she kind of learned on the fly how to get airplanes into a broken airport and to prioritize how to deal in a crisis like that. And once that's gone, it's not coming back.
Boy. Melissa Pabon, P-A-B-O-N.
Yeah.
She was at the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which recalls unsafe products. It could cause crib death or battery fires. And she posted her warnings in English and Spanish. She was fired, and the person who's taking her place doesn't know Spanish.
Right.
So that means
this idea that kind of everything needs can be squeezed, that if you... Right. If you have a department, there are two people working in the department. Let's just cut it in half. One person can take the entire load. And, you know, I'm sure on some level that one person will work very hard and do their best. But, you know, some problems, you know, there's a limit to how much efficiency you can squeeze out of something that's already been squeezed, where you're already working on thin resources.
Right. Brian Himmelstab, I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly, yeah. Highly regarded Foreign Service officer on track to be an ambassador, came back to Washington. Among other things, his son with disabilities had to undergo kidney surgery. They just fired him.
Yeah, well, this is a story that kind of broke my heart, because here's a guy who was able to, because of his devotion to country, moved his family around the world, even though his son had medical difficulties, wheelchair bound. It was not an easy thing to do with his family. His son has a medical crisis, and so he moves back to Washington. And it's just the capriciousness of this, and the cruelty that James was talking about. They fire him. And if he had been abroad, which is what he intended to do, they wouldn't have fired him. It was just the fact that he was tending to his son that put him in the firing line. But to me, it was just so inspiring to hear about the sacrifices that he and his family were able to make over time for the United States of America, and then to see it rewarded with just such callousness, and to just generally see the arbitrariness of the fact that they didn't go in and say, all right, who's underperforming here? Maybe we could clear out some of the dead weight. Instead, they just whacked whatever they could whack. And this was a guy who had worked in the equivalent of the State Department Situation Room, where he would stay in overnight, and he'd been to all over the world, working his way up from a consular officer. He had the most experience. He's exactly who you'd want to be an ambassador, which he would have become because he was regarded highly, but arbitrarily dismissed.
And the moral comparison between someone like him and Russell Voigt or Elon Musk and Donald Trump is positively stunning. I mean, they don't care.
What they don't understand is, or maybe they do understand they don't care, but so many of our government employees, our civilian employees, had military careers that once you are devoted to a career of service and your career in the military ends, you don't turn around and say, hey, I'm just going to go make a lot of money right now. A lot of these people wanted to continue to serve their nation, and they found careers in places like the FDA or the State Department. I was struck by how many people I encountered who were inspired to enter the government after 9/11, that they had seen that moment. They remembered that moment where we cared for one another and that our government kind of stepped up to respond to a crisis. And that was a moment they felt inspired to go look for a job in the federal bureaucracy. And we've rewarded that patriotic impulse in the most disgraceful, undignified treatment.
Well, my final, and I'll turn to James, is the right wing loves this. I caught Laura Ingraham's segment. My excuse is that I was actually surfing looking for a football game, but they were talking about Trump's greatest achievement was getting rid of 300,000 federal employees. You know, I would predict, Franklin, when the consequences, when those Medicare and Social Security checks or information is in process, when some of the IRS is unable to get back refunds as quickly as possible, answer questions, some of these right-wingers may start to have a slightly different view.
I mean, ideology is a tough thing to penetrate.
Some of their followers, at least.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, having a functioning, competent government is essentially a prerequisite for being a great nation. And if you allow your government to fall into a state of disrepair, I think that so much of our national life and our sense of who we are and our ability to do important things in the world, it's going to diminish.
James?
So, Frank, you alluded to this, but I want to drive down on it's important. George Wallace used to say, with a bunch of pointy-haired bureaucrats riding their bicycle to work, obviously, being these old people in Washington have anything to do but mess with your life. And you keep hearing this about these Washington bureaucrats, which not actually, and you talked about it, but talk about it a little bit more. How much of the federal workforce is in actually Washington, D.C., and how much of it is really out in the country? And are these people aloof from you, or in many ways, are they your neighbors?
They're your neighbors. I mean, 80% of the country, the government is outside of Washington, D.C., which is a stunning fact that stunned even me. And I felt like I was a pretty good student of our government, that, this is impacting national parks. It's impacting veterans hospitals. It's, you take something like the Social Security offices, they don't exist. They exist in Washington, D.C. for sure, but they're in Atlanta and they're in San Francisco and they're in Texas. They're all over the country. That food and safety inspectors don't exist in Washington, D.C. because the food safety plants are not in Washington, D.C. You need, right. These are people who are out there, like, all over the country. And right. That's, Washington, D.C. has absorbed a hit over the course of the last year, but you look at the unemployment rates in Virginia, in Maryland, in D.C., they've upticked, but they're not as severe as you would expect given this 300,000 person loss. I mean, it's really dispersed.
Yeah, I thought it was really worth going over again that people really understood, because there's this impression of what the federal workforce is, and it's actually what the federal workforce is. So I'm going to leave you what I think. I really believe this. I think that the Democrat was going to win in 2028. And I think you're going to see a resurgence of patriotism, even among young people. I think you're going to see more people in 2029 applying to work for the federal government. I really do. I really mean this. I think out of this, and you can already feel it starting to turn, that this is really not who we are. And I've thought about it, but I genuinely believe that. I'm 81. I hope I live to see it. But I think there are no reasons to be short-term optimistic, but there are some reasons to be immediate-term. I think the United States is going to turn towards patriotism and away from this whatever we have now. I really believe that.
I think about this with my daughters who I think I want there to be a place where they can serve, right? That they, if they, service is noble, and having a career where you represent the United States of America seems to me like it could, it should be one of the highest callings in our land. And I just hope that that there are outlets for that service. And I include the military in this as well, where, you know, I think that we need to, I hope to God that that the military preserves its professionalism at the end of this period. And that's not one more institution that needs to be reformed and revived. I feel grateful that so many of the norms and ethos of our military, I think, is so strong that I hope that it's resistant to the types of pressures that we're seeing elsewhere.
One of the things that's kind of universally sort of thought of, they're just bureaucrats and these labor unions. On 9/11, of every one of those firemen that went up those stairs and died had two things in common. They were government employees and they were in a union. What else you want to tell me? You want to tell me that government employees are no good or unions are no good? I mean, stop and think about that. One of the greatest acts of heroism where these firemen, these young firemen, were going into almost certain death. And they had their government identification and their union card on them. People should remember that. Thank you so much, Frank. And Your piece really touched me and moved me just because of the way I grew up.
Thank you.
Boy, James, that's a great note to end on. Franklin, thank you. And everybody out there, I want you to get, I read it digitally. I assume it's in a magazine too, but it's Franklin's piece in The Atlantic, The Government Workers Donald Trump Discarded. It's really a hell of an important piece. And thank you so much for being with us, Franklin.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Hey, now for the outrage of the week. Remember last week we talked to Mary Claire Jelinek, the Associated Press, great journalist, whose book featured interviews with the participants in the Trump-inspired violent mob that on January 6th tried to overturn a legitimate election. Joe Biden clearly beat Trump in that election, although Trump now wants to still relitigate it and still talk about it with his lackeys at the Justice Department. Most Republicans know this is only about his ego and his lies. But there was some more proof that came out this week. In the 2022 Georgia grand jury, where witnesses are sworn to tell the truth, Lindsey Graham called Trump's claims unnerving and noted that if someone came in and told Trump the Martians stole votes for him, he'd believe it. Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp talked about Trump's fruitless exercise, and the GOP Speaker of the Georgia House suggested his schemes were crazy. Even Fox News realized Trump's claims he was robbed were untrue, a con job, and yet he persists. Still, as a practitioner of the big lie, he believes you tell it enough and people start to believe it, so he's back at it again, even after the Biden-aided comeback, his comeback, enabled him to win the 2024 election. Let's just remind Trump of one reality. In 2020, Biden won a majority of the votes cast. Barack Obama twice won a majority of the votes cast. Trump never has won a majority of the votes, and he lost the 2020 election badly.
So you mentioned the magic word. Remember Groucho Marx and you mentioned a glad, your magic word and a duck would come down, you win $100? You mentioned Lindsey Graham, the magic word.
Yeah.
Maybe the most vile, pathetic political pretzel that ever lived. All right? So I saw this story. Graham, the DNC chief, go to hell. Sent, let's take a little bit, but it's important. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, close ally of President Trump, told Democratic National Committee Chair Ken Martin to go to hell on Monday following a series of social media posts in which Martin compared the U.S. to Iran, accusing both governments of demonstrating authoritarian behavior. Now, who would have a problem with that? All right? And you're right. Trump is not yet the Ayatollah, but he's doing everything he can to be one. He says, Ken Martin is a worthless piece of crap. Lindsey, quit projecting. Quit talking about yourself. All right? And to say that Lindsey Graham is sitting here, who said things worse about Trump, maybe than you and I have said, but it doesn't matter. All right? He's sitting here. He's watching invasion of our cities. He's watching reporters' homes being invaded. He's watching Venezuela be invaded. He's sitting there with one, have no fucking idea. They're talking about even invading Greenland and destroying NATO, and he thinks of himself as some kind of defense and foreign policy expert. This motherfucking guy cannot be any more pathetic than he is. And it proves in the pudding, every time you see a picture of him, you want to bust out laughing because he's turned into an unbelievable clown in American politics that will say and do anything to try to save his fat-ass political skin.
Well, as Christopher Buckley wrote, his real name is Squiggly T. Biscuit, and that's the way I think of him every time I see him. Hey, now for our listener questions. And, you know, if anything, you get better every week. The first is from Crystal in Eugene, Oregon, the home of the Ducks. James, she says she keeps hearing Democrats will run on affordability. And I worry that it's a winning issue, but a promise we can't keep. What policies can we get done?
Oh, first of all, it's a great question. By the way, what's the track stadium? Is it Hayward? Is that the name of the famous, most famous track and field stadium maybe in the world? Is it at Eugene?
Oh, at the Oregon. Yeah, boy, the runners they produced. Yeah.
They are unbelievable. Yeah. So understand that there are two sides to the question called affordability, cost of living, inflation. First of all, since Trump has taken office, inflation has hardly at all declined. I think it went from like 3%, that's inflation, to 2.7, that's still inflation. Things are significantly more expensive today than when he took office. And there's something that you never hear about. There's two sides to this affordability issue. One is how much you pay for a good. That is important. The tariffs are certainly adding something to the inflation rate. We can argue about how much. The other thing equally important is how much money you make. So if you make a dollar and a good cost you $1.05, you're down. However, if the same good costs you $1.05, but you make $1.10, you're up. And I think it's very, very important that when you're talking about affordability, which is the new word du jour, that you understand there are two components to this, and that is the price of goods and the amount of money an individual makes. And we're probably not that able to shape the price of goods, but there are smart policies that can increase salaries, and we ought to look at them and try to promote them.
Yeah. You know, there are so many, I mean, you know, healthcare, you know, to start with, but there's so many others. Yeah. Maria, she's in the U.S. via Colombia, says, why aren't our elected leaders pushing for real oversight of ICE and the Department of Justice? Since they aren't, how can concerned citizens translate protest energy into meaningful legislative or policy changes? Maria, I will give you a simple answer, November 2026. You can't do oversight if you're in the minority, and these Republicans have no interest in it whatsoever. They've given a blank check to Trump. That is one of the reasons it's absolutely critical. I don't think in my lifetime there has been a more important midterm election. If the Democrats win the House and the Senate, you're going to see an effort at oversight. I don't think that'll stop Trump because he doesn't believe in the rule of law, but it will, I think, expose a lot of the evil that is being done. So when you ask that question, the answer is simple, November 2026.
I could not agree with you more. It is the most important election, off year election that I can imagine. And remember this, we have to have what I call a John Hancock election. Remember when John Hancock signed the Declaration of Independence, he wanted so bold that the King of England could read it without his glasses. We need a result that people that comment on elections and people that talk about it have no other interpretation but that it was a massive rejection of Donald Trump. Because I'm going to tell you, they're going to look for anything to keep the story alive. Oh, he's more powerful than you think, James. I'd never vote for him. But you got to admit, he's got some underlying political magic like the likes that we've never seen. Well, let's just see what happens in November. And I think we're on the verge, and it's very important we have this. It's very important that we have a John Hancock election. It is not good enough that we win because it will get interpreted as something else, I promise you. We got to win like we won in November 2025, and I think we will in November 2026, but it's very important that we win in a way that is only offers one interpretation, and that is the rejection of Donald John Trump and his policies.
Yeah, yeah. John in Chicago says there have been impressive anti-Trump rallies this year. He wants to know, James, are you surprised there haven't been many, hardly any pro-Trump rallies? Is that his supporters are lazy or he just doesn't have the mojo anymore?
Maybe ask that reporter from the Atlantic that says that MAGA still loves him no matter what. Well, they don't think they're going to show up at his rallies like they used to. Now, are they? And the reason that he doesn't do them is he knows he can't draw the same crowds that he used to. And he's always measured his potency by his crowd size. Well, okay, good. Ask the guy who wrote the story about how Trump remained so invulnerable.
Yeah, I agree. Bill in Houston, Texas, notes that California is a very expensive state. Does that undermine Newsom's ability to run on the issue and weaken his candidacy? I don't think so, Bill. I mean, he's running. The 2028 presidential election is going to be the antidote to Donald Trump. I don't know that Gavin Newsom is the best candidate. I think he's in the top tier right now, along with four or five others. And I think that, there are a lot of things you can talk about California that are pretty good. I did note, interestingly, he opposes the billionaires tax out there now. I don't know if that's a good or a bad idea, but I think Governor Newsom will be a contender.
I do too. You know, one of the things that you hope in this cycle is the talent level is good and that people will improve. I got to say that Newsom, I think, is a very improved communicator. And say the same thing for Beshear and other people, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is going to be a very fast track that these guys are running now. And look, California, if it were a nation, I think it'd be the fourth largest economy in the world. I can't tell you how many patents, what percent of the patents that come out of the U.S. come out of California, or what its GDP is. And I got to tell you, I go out there a lot and a lot of stuff in California works. It's stuck. Everybody's leaving, but you're stuck in traffic. I don't understand it, but that's what they claim. Plus, they got in and out work.
I think the next question, this is Ivan in Los Angeles, who says, you remember how effective the video of Kamala Harris defending her support for transgender surgery for prisoners was, the Republican attack video. They seized on that. Why don't Democrats have a communications operation as effective as they do?
Well, we don't have Fox. I mean, whatever, you know, you say, well, you got MS. They actually have editorial standards, which is puts them at somewhat of a disadvantage. And we're not as disciplined as they are. And I think that they know that crap is unpopular, so they got to be more disciplined in how they portray things. But I think the Supreme Court is probably going to rule on this trans athlete issue, which would probably take it off the table a little bit more than it was. We didn't get our messaging right on this whole thing. I have to say that. And I think that we have done, because of this flubbing it, we've actually done more harm to trans people than we would have wanted to. It has been very ineffective, our messaging on this.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Let me raise a different messaging issue. I don't want any Democrats out there talking about abolishing ICE. You talk about reforming ICE. You talk about making ICE work. We should have learned that lesson last time. When you say abolishing ICE, you know what they're going to say? You want them pouring across the borders. And what you want to do in immigration is go back to the Obama policy, a tough border policy with a pathway to citizenship. Don't talk about abolishing ICE.
Yeah, I said, and I believe it, that defund the police are the three stupidest words in the history of the English language. The left is universally wrong about everything. People don't want to, they want to have some kind of immigration and customs control. Now, whether ICE is present or true, I think it's horrible. And you look at what it takes to be an FBI agent and what it takes to be an ICE agent. And you look at the screening that they go through. So we're just taking some of these ICE agents are dedicated law enforcement professionals. I'll be the first to admit that, although I suspect it might be a smaller percent than you imagine. And a lot of them are just a pack of people that couldn't get a job anywhere else that figured they got a chance with not very much training to carry a badge and a gun and shoot people. All right? And that's the real danger. The danger is not that we have immigration and customs enforcement. We need that. The danger is we don't have an expert workforce dealing with that at all. And it needs to be exposed about training and the backgrounds and the tests and the social media scrubs and everything else we do before we hire these people.
James, our next question is one that I'm going to have to comment on after I finish the question. It's from Rob in Rosemont, Pennsylvania. It's in the Philadelphia Main Line where I grew up. And he says his 92-year-old father attended my high school, and his 90-year-old mother-in-law says she dated every guy in my dad's class. I want to quickly point out, Rob, I did not date your mother-in-law. I was too young, I promise. I'm not going to say how much too young, but I was too young. Although I probably wish I could have. She sounds like a really interesting woman. But both were longtime Republicans, and both have enthusiastically participated in protest rallies. How do we convince Kristi Noem and her MAGA followers that these two are not domestic terrorists? Rob, you can't. Because they don't care. They demagogue because that's all they have. And you are so right. And you know, when I was growing up, Rosemont, Pennsylvania was the heart of Eisenhower country. It was 70% Republican. Last time, I'm pretty sure you can correct me if I'm wrong. Last, I don't know, five elections, maybe more, it voted Democratic. But don't think you're going to convince Kristi Noem of anything because, first of all, I don't think she's terribly intelligent. And second of all, she doesn't really care.
I agree. She's too stupid to know what's going on around her. And, you know, wearing costumes everywhere she goes. I mean, she's one of the, it's hard to emerge, but she's one of the true laughing stock of this whole administration. I mean, she hadn't achieved Lindsey Graham status yet, but she's trying. She's trying.
Well, with Corey Lewandowski's help, she could get there.
Could get there. I'd take a little bet on that Kristi can be the most ridiculous member of this administration. But you got to remember, there's a lot of competition there. But she's pretty good.
Oh, I mean, you're talking Stephen. But no, you're talking Stephen Miller. You're talking Pete Hegseth. You're talking if the competition's Steve James.
Promised $50,000 in a cover bag. Hold it. And we can't forget him.
Yeah.
Matt, you're about to attack
him. All right. Our final question is from Matt in Cleveland, Ohio. James, what assurance can you offer that the midterms and the 28 election will be conducted fairly and the results will be honored?
I can't. But what I do know is the more we're ungone, the more that we talk about it, the more that they know we know, the harder it is for them to do it. And I think I'm pretty confident, Al, I'm going to let you talk about this a little bit more, but a little closer, but you follow it. We're putting together some first-class legal teams that can be deployed, that are ready to go. But let's say you live in Rosemount, okay? You're for Floyd, you get to vote, but start organizing people because they're going to try to seize ballots in North Philadelphia. You can drive into Center City. You can have sit-ins. You can do all kinds of stuff to point out what they're doing. They're counting on you to not be organized. They're counting that the Democrats are going to be asleep at the wheel and they're going to pull all this authoritarian bullshit and not count votes, and you're not going to say anything and make their assumption wrong. Be organized. Be ready to go at a moment's notice. For lack of a better word, I'd call them minute people. I guess we get gender like minute men, but minute people that are ready to be deployed at a minute's notice to stop them from stealing the election from the American people, because you know they're going to try. You know that.
The three most important folks in these elections are, first, the candidates. Secondly, the people like you, Matt, and Rob and Rosemont, follow what James said. And third are the lawyers. Unfortunately, we really have to get, I say unfortunately, because they're going to try to steal it. The team that the Biden people put together after the 2020 election was as good as it gets. Seth Waxman, Don Verrilli, our late great friend, the Walter Dellinger, and they have to replicate that this time.
Yeah, I think that they will. I mean, I think there's, Buddy could just get all of the people that quit the Justice Department and put them in place somewhere. Take, for instance, to Minneapolis U.S. Attorney's Office. They've got a lot of talented lawyers that are going to want to be a part of this, I promise you.
Yeah. Listen, we love those questions, and I'm sorry we didn't get to them all, but, you know, please send them in again next week and we'll try to get to them. It is really, you know, one of the real highlights of this program every week. So please keep those questions coming in, and thank you.
Absolutely. It's great.
Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hine. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Green Chef, Delete Me, 3-Day Blinds, and Miracle Made, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them. When you do, it helps make this podcast happen. So to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast site. Now remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.